Chapter 3. Confucian Korea. The Joseon Dynasty, 1392-1910. Frontier warriors and ideological zealots. The establishment of the Joseon Dynasty. Cheng Dojun and his 14th-century colleagues had a vision of a virtuous society, one that would be in harmony with the way of heaven, where peace, prosperity, and human-heartedness prevailed. This vision, dubbed Neo-Confucianism by modern Western scholars, was based on a line of teachings derived from Song Dynasty Chinese interpretations of the ancient Confucian classics. The vehicle for fulfilling this vision was the newly established Joseon Dynasty. To a remarkable degree, these scholarly zealots succeeded in their project of remolding Korean society in accordance with their understanding of the way. Starting at the top, with the king and his officials, they developed a set of institutions and values that penetrated deep into Korean society. It was a generations-long process, but by the 18th century, Korea was the world's most thoroughly Confucian society. When Lee Sung-kae founded the new Joseon Dynasty, he emphasized continuity over change. Even the name he chose harkened back to ancient times. He created no new institutions and conducted no massive purges. In fact, the new dynasty was for the most part dominated by the same families and officials that had served the old. Rather than one dominant social group replacing another, a number of new people joined the ruling aristocracy of landed officials and scholars. Lee Sung-kae was one of these. His father was an ethnic Korean who served as a minor Mongol official, and his mother was of Chinese origin. Lee came up through the ranks in the Korea army, where he distinguished himself in campaigns along the troublesome northern frontiers and against Japanese pirates. He was the last Korean leader with a military background until the 20th century. King Taecho, as Lee became known, had the support of some other military men and many officials who felt that the Wang family of Korea had lost the mandate of heaven, and of scholars who were eager for the opportunity to reform society. Taecho tried to gain acceptance, if not support, from the rest of the elite. Many were won over to the new dynasty, but not all. The most prominent of those that resisted the order was the highly respected scholar Cheng Mon-chu, 1337-92. Taecho tried to charm the learned man into accepting the new dynasty by exchanging poems with him, but Cheng was adamant in his loyalty to the Korea state. Taecho's fifth son, Yi Pangwon, less patient and more ruthless than his father, held a party in Cheng Mon-chu's honor and then had him murdered on his way home. It is said that bloodstains can still be seen on the bridge in Kaesong, where this incident took place. Even though the creation of Joseon in 1392 was not marked by a major upheaval, it was more than just a change of dynasty. Among Yi Sung-kae's supporters were the Confucian scholars who had become enamored with the new form of Confucianism brought back from China. These scholars aimed at nothing less than to remake Korea according to their understanding of this ideology. These Confucian zealots were all men of learning recognized by their peers and were moral leaders in their communities. Though they have been termed Neo-Confucianists by modern historians, they would probably be puzzled by that designation, since they didn't believe they were creating anything new. Rather, their aim was to recapture the original line of teachings of the ancient sages that were refined by the old Chinese master, and to restore the moral standards that had been lost. It might be better to refer to them as they saw themselves, as Confucian revivalists. They often called themselves followers of the way, meaning the true way to virtue. To them, that meant living in harmony with the moral order of the universe, which, according to their beliefs, required placing the family and the state on a firm moral basis. Many Confucian revivalists were teachers, but for most, the highest calling was to serve in public office. In doing so, they could ensure that society was being governed according to correct moral principles. They were especially focused on the ruler, believing that he upheld the moral and social order of society through his personal example of virtuous conduct, and by governing with concern for the welfare of his subjects. It therefore mattered greatly to them that the ruler maintained high ethical standards and a strong awareness of the moral dimension of his role in society. The leaders of this movement saw in Yi Song-ke and his family a new dynasty that could provide such rulers and that could serve as a means of purifying Korean society. Remaking Society in Accordance with the Way, the Neo-Confucian Revolution. The Confucian revivalist officials carried out their project with zeal and succeeded in remolding Korean society to an extent that has no parallel elsewhere in East Asia. China never experienced such a sustained and systematic effort to remodel the institutions of its government and its society, nor did Japan or Vietnam, although both officially adopted Neo-Confucianism. Perhaps the best parallel to the efforts by the Neo-Confucian literati at creating a virtuous society can be found in the Islamic revivals prior to the mid-19th century. One way the Korean Neo-Confucian literati resembled the Muslim revivalists was their intolerance of any deviation from the orthodoxy. The Confucian revivalists were especially hostile to Buddhism. They chided monks for their moral laxity and their involvement in politics, and criticized the expense of supporting temples and performing elaborate rituals. Monks produced nothing of value and relied on others to feed them, and Buddhism, in their opinion, did not respect the social relations that held society together. Its tradition of celibacy was a threat to family and lineage, and its concept of abstract universal love was inimical to the hierarchical love in Confucianism that gave primacy to family, then to friends, and then to neighbors. It encouraged withdrawal from society, not active participation in it. Buddhist monks, devoting their lives to meditation and prayer, were seen as self-indulgent, immoral people who neglected their duties to family and society. However, this harsh antipathy toward Buddhism and other forms of worship, such as shamanism, was a minority view at the start of the dynasty. Members of the royal family continued to patronize Buddhism for the first century of the dynasty and sometimes consulted with shamans. Indeed, the monarchs in general were less enthusiastic about radical change than the Neo-Confucianist reformers. Yet the reformers gradually got their way, and most of the temples in cities and towns closed. Buddhist places of worship were banished to the mountains and remote places where they continued to offer refuge and solace to those who needed it. Buddhism never disappeared, but it was marginalized, robbed of its political and economic influence as well as much of its intellectual and cultural vitality. Nor did shamanism and the worship of nature spirits disappear, but their role in society was weakened, and shamans became socially stigmatized. Confucian revivalists relied on several institutions to promote their reform agenda: the censorate, the classics mat lecture program, and the civil examination system. The censorate, which was originally borrowed from China and had existed in the Goryeo kingdom, became powerful during the Chosun period. It was, from a modern point of view, a peculiar and even sinister institution. It was a body consisting of mostly younger scholars, the idea being that people should be selected before they had a chance to be corrupted, while they still had energy and their idealism was undiminished. One branch of the censorate focused on scrutinizing state officials, examining the backgrounds of both appointees and their families. Candidates for office not only had to have records of unblemished moral character, but had to come from families that were scandal-free. Even a wayward grandparent could be grounds for disqualification. These members of the censorate reviewed the conduct of officials in office to see that they were acting properly not only in public, but also in their private lives. Another branch of the censorate monitored the conduct of the king. Censors frequently admonished monarchs for unethical or otherwise improper behavior. In short, the censorate were the moral guardians or moral police of the state. Since most censors were well schooled in the tenets of Neo-Confucianism and adhered to them faithfully, the censorate functioned as one of the institutional bases for the great undertaking of making Korea a model Confucian society. Another institution created by Confucian revivalists to reform government and society was the classics mat. Modeled on the Song China Institution, the Classics Mat was a lecture program organized with a staff of 21. It consisted of 3 sessions a day where the king would read and discuss the Confucian classics and commentaries on the classics by such luminaries as 12th century Chinese Confucian scholar Chu Xi. The Classics Mat was designed to guide the monarch, and it served as an agency for promoting Neo-Confucian concepts at court. Kings were supposed to attend all 3 sessions, although they seldom adhered to this rather impractical arrangement. Conscientious kings such as Sei Cheng, ruled 1418 to 50, did attend daily. As if the lectures and scrutiny weren't enough for the king, he also had to deal with the historians. In most societies, historians might be read, but they are seldom taken seriously. Not so in Joseon, Korea. The role historians played at court was nothing short of extraordinary. 2 accompanied the king daily, one recording his words and the other his gestures and facial expressions. It was almost impossible for the king to have a private conversation with his officials without a pair of historians present. In fact, it was such a rare occurrence that when it did happen, it became a major scandal. At the end of each reign, the historians would compile a detailed record to be used as guidance for future monarchs. No king was allowed to see the historians' notes. Any such requests were simply refused. Of course, it wasn't just the king, but all his officials who were observed in this way. Their every misdeed and failure to live up to the moral standards required of those in leadership would receive the final recorded judgments of the historians. The Neo-Confucianists also used their curriculum of the civil service examinations to promote their ideals. Since passing the exam was the most important means of acquiring state office and validating one's status, basing the exams on the orthodox Neo-Confucian canon inculcated officials with its values and beliefs. State-sponsored schools trained young men of the Yongpan aristocratic class. Each county had an official school for local aristocratic boys to begin preparing them for the civil service exams. The brightest could go on to the prestigious Songkyun Kwan Confucian Academy in Seoul that was created early in the dynasty. In these ways, then, the Joseon state became an ideologically oriented one. Under a virtuous king, Sejong, Hangul, and the Golden Age, Taecho had many sons, perhaps too many. His 5th son, Yi Pengwan, played a key role in his father's 1392 coup and expected to succeed him. The influential Cheng Dojun, however, supported the 8th son, Yi Pengsuk. Not to be deterred, Yi Pengwan, who had already killed the famed scholar Cheng Monju, then had Cheng Dojun and Yi Pengsuk murdered. Depressed and weary, Taecho abdicated and placed his 2nd son on the throne as King Chongchun. But Chongchun, fearing, with good reason, his ruthless younger brother, named Yi Pengwan, crown prince, and then abdicated after a brief reign. Yi Pengwan, as King Taechong, ruled 1400 to 18, kept intact the policies of Cheng Dojun, whom he had murdered, and continued to promote the Neo-Confucian project. While in many ways an able leader, he was a ruthless tyrant, so suspicious of sharing his authority, that he executed or exiled many of those who had helped him gain the throne, lest they try to cash in on their support or shift their support to another of Taecho's many offspring. Taecheng, in contrast to his father, had only 4 sons. His 1st was designated as heir, but was too fond of hunting and pleasure-seeking, and his 2nd son became a monk, so in 1481 Taecheng made his 3rd son his heir and retired shortly afterward. This son, King Sejong, is considered by Koreans today as their greatest monarch, and there are compelling arguments to support this case. His greatness wasn't obvious at first. When he became king at age 21, he was a semi-puppet, since his father continued to run the country from retirement. Only when his father died in 1422 was Sejong able to rule on his own. His talent for leadership soon became apparent. He led a series of successful campaigns against Japanese pirates in the south, bringing to an end their frightening attacks on coastal villages. In the north, he personally led successful campaigns against the Chuduchens, pushing the northern border to where it remains today at the Yalu and Tumen rivers. His string of military victories and skillful diplomacy would have been enough to ensure his place in history. However, it was his sterling character and the cultural achievements of his reign that make him admired by Koreans. A sincere Confucian, he made an effort to act in accordance with the ideal of a virtuous prince who leads the people by moral example. He studied the Confucian classics and attended the classics mat lectures, which he took very seriously, and worked to promote and strengthen Confucianism. Se Chung's earnest devotion to Neo-Confucian principles and his energetic pursuit of both those principles and his own leadership abilities contributed greatly to the progress of creating a morally sound society following the way of heaven. Perhaps what Se Chung is best known for is the creation of Hangul, the Korean alphabet. Before his reign, Koreans mainly wrote in classical Chinese. Several systems had been developed since Silla times for writing Korean using Chinese characters, but none of them caught on. The problem was that two languages could hardly be more different than Chinese and Korean. Literacy in Chinese required mastery of thousands of characters, making writing in Korean extremely cumbersome. Se Chung sought to solve the problem by creating a simple form of writing that was better suited for Korean. It would be easy to learn and phonetical, thus promoting literacy. He established a committee that studied the various writing systems they were familiar with and came up with a unique, ingenious system that works well for the complicated Korean language. The Hangul alphabet not only accommodated the complex Korean sound system, but the letters themselves were based on stylized shapes of the tongue and mouth when making a sound. The result is the most scientific system of writing in the world. The work was finished in 1443 and was promoted in 1446 with a manual called the Hunmin Chongum, Correct Sounds for Instructing the People. For several centuries, Chinese was still widely used for government records and even for literature. Many Yangpan still looked down on the new written system, denigrating it as vulgar script or women's script, the latter implying it was only good for untutored females. But in the 20th century, it became the main form of writing in Korean, as well as a symbol of Korean identity and cultural achievement. The Good King's reign was also a time of technical innovation. Many inventions were aimed at ensuring good harvests and promoting knowledge of agricultural techniques. To keep track of rainfall, the state set up a system of rain gauges, called chuki, throughout the kingdom, establishing what remains the world's longest record of measured rainfall. There were attempts to improve on the calendar and the measurement of time. Chang Yongshi, a particularly talented tinkerer, developed a highly accurate self-striking water clock and a sundial. Security being another major concern, experiments were made in weaponry, including a multi-barreled cannon and the world's first ironclad ships. In his last years, Se Chung had to deal with diabetes, the loss of his eyesight, and worries about leaving an heir who was very sickly and unlikely to be able to provide the strong leadership he hoped would continue to fortify the kingdom. Yet he could look back with pride. He had secured the borders, brought the country to an economic and cultural height, promoted Confucianism in society, and left behind the Hangul writing system, which was both a symbol of Korean identity and a vehicle for it. Not all Joseon kings were models of Confucian behavior. Yonsan Chung, ruled 1492 to 1592, was the anti-Se Chung, a cruel and vindictive tyrant. In his first few years, the young monarch governed reasonably enough, but then went bad. He attempted to abolish the censorate when it issued criticism of his conduct and banished or killed many officials who challenged his authority. He even had the body of an official dug up and the remains mutilated. He shut down the main Confucian academy, the Sung Kyun Kwan, and turned a major Buddhist temple into a pleasure palace in which he gathered women and horses from around the country. Upon his orders, 20,000 Seoul residents were evicted so he could turn their neighborhood into a royal hunting ground. Commoners were forced to labor on these projects. When they began to put up posters in Hangul mocking him, he had the new script banned. All this was too much, and his own officials deposed him. He was posthumously downgraded from a king to a prince, since no king could have acted in such a manner. Like all Chosun kings, Yosun Chung discovered that there were limits to royal power. The not always virtuous politics of Chosun. Chosun politics hardly resembled the picture of staid aristocrats peacefully seeking office by mastering Confucian texts and triumphing on the civil exams. Rather, the 5 centuries of the dynasty can be read as a fierce and unending story of intrigue and struggle among aristocratic factions as they competed for power. Vying for public position among the Yongpan was a high-stakes game. To an even greater extent than in earlier times, holding prominent office was the main way for individuals and families to maintain high status, gain access to power, and secure their family's wealth. Factional politics, focused on jockeying for key positions at court, was couched in the language of Confucian principles. The very attempt to create a virtuous society added to the viciousness of politics, since in this Confucian society, proper personal behavior by officials and the correct performance of rituals at court were necessary to maintain the harmony and prosperity of the state. Misbehavior and incorrect performance of duties could jeopardize the whole project and bring the wrath of heaven down upon society. As a result, even seemingly trivial matters became the cause of serious disputes. For example, when King Hyocheong died in 1659, it was unclear whether his mother, the Queen Dowager, should mourn for 1 year since he was her son, or for 3 years since he was a king. The canonical texts being unclear on this, one faction argued for 1 year, and another for 3. There were many other equally arcane disagreements, and their consequences were not trivial. Being on the losing side of one of these disputes could mean not only the loss of one's position in government, but could result in banishment or execution. Losers were banished to remote locations, such as small islands off the south coast, where Yongpan would be far from the court and cut off from his family, with only illiterate fisher folk as his companions. There was nothing to do but study, read, and hope that the fortunes of his faction would take a more positive turn. Life as ritual, marriage, family, and death in Chosun Korea. Amidst factional strife, the project of shaping society according to Neo-Confucian literati vision continued. During the Chosun era, the country became a Confucian society to a greater extent than it had ever been a Buddhist one. Confucianism emphasized the importance of family relations, the hierarchical nature of society, the necessity for order and harmony, respect for elders and for authority, and the importance of a clear distinction between men and women. Most of these were held as important in all pre-modern societies, but Confucianism made them its central principles, reinforced by rituals and ceremonies and by the study of the classic texts. Confucianism begins with the family as the basic unit of society. All other institutions are patterned on it. The state, for example, is sort of a big family, with the king as the father. Families were bound together by a web of obligations reinforced by rituals and ceremonies, with each member performing his or her role. The most important principle that held the family together was hyo, or filial piety. One's duties and obligations extended not only to the living but also to past and future generations. That is, one always had to be aware of one's conduct in light of what the ancestors would say about it and how it would affect one's descendants. Each family kept a careful record of their lineage and maintained ancestral gravesites. The graves of the ancestors were visited on special days. Family members prostrated themselves 3 times before the ancestors' grave and presented them with food and wine. Rituals to the family ancestors were performed regularly at home as well. Memorial tablets with the names of family ancestors were taken out, and the head of the household performed prostrations before them. These ceremonies for the family ancestors, known as chesa, became central to Korean ritual life. Children were taught to show respect, obedience, and unquestioning love to parents who reciprocated with their devotion to their children. This was symbolized on New Year's Day, when children in their best clothes bowed before their parents, and the parents in turn gave the children red envelopes containing money. 3 years of mourning were carried out when a parent died, and the date of their death was commemorated annually thereafter by a special ritual ceremony. Everyone had a duty to marry to continue the family lineage. This was so important that a man or woman would be addressed as a child until they married. If a young person died before they wedded, they were often wedded posthumously to a boy or girl who had also died prematurely, ensuring that no family members went unmarried. Virtuous women, being female in Chosun, Korea. No other feature of Korean life was more strikingly transformed under the influence of Chosun Neo-Confucianism than the relations between men and women. A society where men and women mixed so freely and where women had so much independence that it seemed scandalous to the Goryeo-era Chinese visitor Xu Qing became one of the most gender-segregated and male-dominated lands outside the Arabian Peninsula. Women had to be chaste and loyal to their husbands. Widows were no longer allowed to remarry, since they had to be loyal to their husbands for eternity. Girls were often married in childhood, and even if their husbands died before they were fully grown, which was not uncommon in pre-modern times with high death rates, they still had to remain widows. Women were held to a high standard of chastity. Any questioning of women's virtue could bring dishonor to her entire family. Young girls were given a pedo, a small knife with which they would take their own life, if that should happen. A woman who was seduced, raped, or even rumored to have had an affair or been violated was expected to use her pedo to protect her family's reputation. Women did not socialize with men who were not relatives. They were to be silent in men's presence. In fact, talkativeness was grounds for divorce. Since distinction between men and women was a cardinal virtue in Confucianism, women were never to assume a man's role. Joseon-era laws prohibited women from riding horses or playing sports. In fact, the spheres of the two genders were kept so separate that houses had different entrances, one for men and one for women. Inside the home, the men's and women's quarters were separated by the kitchen. Late in the Chosun era, concern for keeping men and women apart went even further. To make sure that they did not mix in public, there were certain areas of the day marked by ringing a bell when only women could be on the street. At all other times, only men could move about. Many upper-class women lived their entire lives secluded behind high walls, with little exposure to men other than relatives. There were tales of girls on swings. Swinging was a popular pastime, going high enough to get a glimpse at the world beyond the walls. If they got sick, they were treated by specially trained women, or were separated from a male doctor by a curtain. In the latter case, the doctor could only feel his patient's pulse with a string that ran under it. Of course, such restrictions were impossible to impose on lower-class women who had to work in the fields alongside men at busy times. But the idea of the strict separation of the sexes and male control penetrated to all levels of society. Two exceptions to the restricted life of women were Kiseng and Mudong. Mudong were shamans, a role that during the Chosun period became principally occupied by women. While officially frowned upon as ignorant superstition, shamanism, as always, remained a significant part of Korean life. How else to deal with the ghosts of the dead and other malevolent spirits that troubled people? Even kings and members of the royal family consulted them. The Mudong's social status was low, but this was not reflected in the respect her powers were given. Women also served as kisang, the Korean equivalent to the Japanese geisha. These were selected as young girls, usually from poor commoner or even low-born families, and were trained to entertain and serve men. Literate and often artistically accomplished, they offered aristocratic men the kind of intellectual and playful companionship that was absent in their ritually circumscribed marriages. A few key sayings, such as Wang Jini, 1506-60, became famous poets. Wang is worth noting. Famed in her day for her beauty, wit, and independent spirit, she won recognition as a writer. She was a master of the shicho, the short, suggestive poem similar to the Japanese haiku. Only a few of her poems survive today, but they are enough to maintain a reputation as an important poet. Wang Jini is a popular subject of film and literature today, admired in both North and South Korea. Yet even this talented woman could not escape the limitations of her status as a woman and a non-aristocrat. All Ki-seng had constricted lives. At best, they could become a concubine or secondary wife of a wealthy young pan. Men in White, being a privileged male in Chosun, Korea. Creating a virtuous society meant establishing a stable social order where everybody had their place. Theoretically, this meant a meritocracy where all rose or fell according to their virtues and talents. Yet, theory aside, Korea remained a highly rank-conscious society, divided into social classes determined by bloodline. Only young pan were allowed to take the civil service exams, not in theory, but in practice. The lower orders of commoners and mean people were excluded. Neo-Confucian literati were concerned that everyone should know their rank so that order could be maintained. To this end, they developed the OPA system, in which people wore identity tags indicating their status. Young pan wore yellow poplar tags, commoners small wooden ones, and there were big wooden ones for slaves. Young pan serving as high-ranking officials wore ivory identity tags, while lower-ranked officials wore ones of deer horn. Each contained the name, date, and place of birth of the wearer. The OPA system also served to aid in tax collection and in catching runaway slaves. Such an elaborate effort to control society was unusual in pre-modern times, and while only intermittently enforced, it was a sign of how far Chosun officials were willing to go to make sure everyone was in their place. Young pan had to be model Confucians and were held to a high standard of moral behavior. They had to make a show of carrying out elaborate rites to their ancestors and conspicuous displays of filial piety. For example, so assiduously did young pan men observe the mourning rites for parents and grandparents that they began wearing white, the color of mourning, all the time. As a result, the white clothes of young pan men, along with their black horsehair hats, easily distinguished them. So did their pipes. When tobacco became popular in Korea in the 17th century, aristocratic men smoked it in pipes with stems so enormously long that they required a servant to light and stoke them. Young pan were different from aristocrats in Europe in that ostentatious shows of wealth were avoided, and there were no palatial mansions. Most lived in modest homes with simple furnishings. Despite their modesty, however, their homes had heated floors and sliding doors to let in air and light, making them more comfortable than the castles and estates of their Western counterparts. Young pan derived their wealth from land usually worked by tenant farmers or slaves. Many were large landowners, but some had only modest holdings and lived just a bit above the poverty level. Even the poorer young pan, however, could be proud of their social status. Most importantly, they had the opportunity to sit for civil service exams and gain public office. The greatest goal of the young pan was to serve in government. Most began tutoring their sons to pass the civil service exams from an early age, as this was the main way to achieve that aim. Young men then attended a local state-sponsored school, or one of the several hundred so-won, private academies that prepared them for the exams and served as centers of Confucian scholarship. Whether or not they became officials, young pan prided themselves as scholars and moral leaders of society. In a society without a clergy, it was the local young pan who provided ethical guidance, often giving public lectures to the commoners. They acted as informal adjudicators of disputes, since most commoners tended to avoid the royal courts, where plaintiffs and witnesses were routinely tortured to determine the truthfulness of their testimony. In spite of their moral pretensions, there was a hedonistic side to the Yongpan life. Aristocratic men often spent time at the Kisang house and frequently became patrons of a particular lady. Pornographic literature and art were discreetly circulated, and Yongpan men could be heavy drinkers. No doubt many Yongpan wasted their rather leisurely lives lounging around the Kisang houses, gambling or dissipating their energies in petty factional politics. Some, however, were men of accomplishment. A few distinguished themselves as poets and amateur artists. Others compiled histories. Some Yongpan came close to being the men of virtue that Confucian revivalists had worked to create. Yi Wang, 1501-70, and Yi Yi, 1536-84, better known by their respective pen names Teke and Yulko, were the most revered of the Confucian philosophers. Both appear on today's South Korean currency. Other Yongpan devoted their time to practical matters, writing treatises on medicine, economics, and social reform. The weight of poverty, being poor in Chosun, Korea. The Neo-Confucian project of transforming the country to a truly virtuous one was aimed at the elite, but gradually trickled down to commoners. Most ordinary folks adopted the ritual practices of their betters and internalized many Confucian values. A few older traditions survived. For example, mixed drinking and dancing between men and women remained common. Yet even commoners faithfully carried out the rites to the ancestors and accepted the Confucian concepts of virtue. Virtuous or not, life for commoners remained rough and hard. Most peasants did not have enough land to support their families and had to work part of the time on Yongpan estates. When bad weather damaged the harvest, hunger was widespread. Grain was stored for these occasions in government granaries, but it was lent, not given, and thus could put a poor commoner family deep into debt. Rice farming, with its transplanting and weeding, was labor-intensive work. But there were times for recreation, such as attending markets held once or twice a week. That is, every 5 or 10 days. A Korean week had 10 days. There were weddings and festivals. Card games were popular, as were wrestling matches, and always drinking. But these were brief respites in a hard life. Commoners could not rise in status. There was little social mobility in Korea's rigid society. Still, the poorest commoner could console himself that he was not a slave or an outcast. Slavery was quite common in the early Joseon period, with as much as a third of the population being enslaved. In no way did this resemble slavery in the Americas, however. There were no big plantations, nor ethnic or racial distinctions, and freed slaves easily blended into society. In fact, Korean slavery was complicated. There were 4 legal classifications. Some were chattel slaves with virtually no rights or property. Others were landowners, differing from ordinary peasants in status, but not much else. A few landowning slaves who became wealthy were, as strange as this may seem, slave owners themselves. Slave families usually lived in their own section of a village and did not, as a rule, intermarry with commoners. One group of commoners who tended to prosper more than most were the merchants. Korean commerce, however, was not as sophisticated as China's or Japan's. Cities were smaller, the merchant class more modest and less wealthy, and the volume of trade smaller than in neighboring countries. Geography explains much of this. China, like Europe, had great rivers that provided easy highways facilitating transport. Also, like Europe, Japan had protected seas linking population centers, most significantly the Inland Sea. Korea had neither of these. The mountains and hills made overland travel difficult. The rivers did not connect regions of the country. Furthermore, the high tides and sandbars made coastal navigation challenging. As a result, trade often consisted of peddlers burdened with A-frame backpacks making their way over narrow mountain footpaths. But geography can be overcome, and Koreans were able to construct a fairly centralized and uniform government in spite of living in a country full of valleys and small plains separated by mountains. Geography was not the only explanation for such a modest level of commercial development. Cultural norms hindered commerce as well. Confucianists looked down on trade. Merchants and bankers were viewed as villains who got their wealth from others but produced nothing themselves. Even the innkeepers who housed them were lumped in with butchers and gravediggers as outcasts. The officialdom who governed the country for the most part, and there were exceptions, failed to appreciate the role or importance of commerce in strengthening the kingdom and promoting the welfare of its people. Businesses were restricted to licensed shops and hobbled by government price controls. Government decrees prohibited the mining of the silver and gold that the country possessed, lest it attract China's attention and cause it to demand tribute payments of precious metals. This did not help commerce either. In the absence of precious metals, money was restricted to clunky copper coins that had to be strung together in heavy ropes of cash. Bolts of cotton were often used as another, even more cumbersome medium of exchange. One aspect of society that did not change, despite the efforts of the Neo-Confucianists, was the importance of the spirit world among commoners. While Confucianism acknowledges no gods, afterlife, or eternal soul, most Koreans lived in a world inhabited by Guixin, spirits. There were spirits of the dead that could haunt them or bring disease and misfortune. These required a shaman to placate. The natural world of mountains, trees, and rock outcroppings were the abode of spirits. The most important, the mountain spirit San Xin, had a shrine in almost every Buddhist temple. The women of the house made offerings to household gods, like those of the kitchen and the gate, and those dwelling in the storage jars. There was even a god that protected the outhouse. In every village, there was a shrine for the local guardian god. And Pung Su, or geomancy as it is called in the West, was practiced by everyone. Even the state employed geomancers. Buildings and gravesites, even the capital, Seoul, were situated according to geomantic principles, often with the aid of professional geomancers. Fending off the invaders. Foreign policy. In the early 15th century, the Chuuru Chens, outside the northern borders, were subdued. Those inside the border were brought under control and eventually assimilated into Korean society, and the Japanese pirates that plagued the south were defeated. Relations with the Ming, though a bit shaky at first, improved. Korean rulers, seeking the legitimacy that recognition from the Chinese emperor conferred, sent tribute missions to Beijing. At first, these were sent every 3 years, then annually, and then 3 times a year, starting with the New Year's mission. These missions provided opportunities for trade and cultural exchange. The Koreans exported cloth and ginseng and brought silk, medicines, books, and Chinese porcelains into the country. Tribute missions could number in the hundreds and were a great opportunity for Koreans to travel and keep up with the intellectual, cultural, and fashion trends in China. The long period of peace, carefully established in the early Joseon, came to a sudden end with the Japanese invasion of Korea in 1592. While they covered a shorter period and were less destructive than those of the Mongols, the Japanese invasions remain more strongly seared into the memory of the Korean people, reinforced perhaps by Tokyo's colonization and rule in the first half of the 20th century. The Japanese military hegemon and megalomaniac Toyotomi Hideyoshi, 1536-98, emerging as the effective ruler of Japan after a long series of bloody conflicts, launched his plan to take Korea by force and use it as a base to conquer China. He assembled a force of 250,000 fighters in what was probably the greatest overseas invasion in history prior to the 20th century. The Korean court discounted warnings of a possible attack, including alerts from Yi Sun-shin, a military official who was out of royal favor at the time, and was thus caught unprepared when the initial force of 53,000 men landed in Pusan. The well-trained Japanese forces, equipped with muskets as well as swords, pikes, and arrows, marched through the country, slaughtering the ill-equipped, hastily assembled Korean forces. In only 3 weeks, they captured Seoul, and crowds of Koreans jeered and threw rocks at their king and his courtiers as they fled northward. The Chinese quickly responded to Chosun's request for help and were able to stop the Japanese advance at Pyongyang. The war became a stalemate for a while, paralleling the later Korean War, where one side held the southern part of the country and another the north. In 1597, Hideyoshi sent a second wave of invaders. This time, the better-prepared Koreans, with their Chinese allies, were able to contain the Japanese advance to the south. Stalemated on land and harassed on sea, the Japanese withdrew shortly after Hideyoshi's death in 1598. The East Asian War of 1592-98, as it is called by some modern historians, was one of the major international conflicts of the pre-modern era, with hundreds of thousands of combatants and vast casualties. A reminder of its brutality and scale can be seen today in Mimizuka, Mound of Ears, in Kyoto, where the pickled ears of 38,000 Koreans and Chinese, trophies of war, are buried. The hero of the war was the aforementioned Admiral Yi Sun-shin, 1545-98. Although Yi came from a family of civil officials, he chose to take the military test rather than the more prestigious civil exam. A victim of factional politics, he was out of power, and his entreaties for military preparedness were ignored at the time of the Japanese invasion. Called back to office by the chastened court, Yi supervised the construction of a fleet of ships that carried on a successful naval campaign, sinking hundreds of Japanese ships and making it difficult for Hideyoshi to continue sending forces to the peninsula. One of Admiral Yi's innovations was the Kobuk-sun, turtle ships, which were the world's first ironclad vessels, predating the Monitor and the Merrimack of the U.S. Civil War by more than 2.5 centuries. These ships resisted Japanese naval gunfire and were well designed to ram and sink enemy ships. Admiral Yi Sun-shin died in combat toward the end of the conflict. Today he is a national hero whose statue stands prominently in downtown Seoul. No doubt a military strategist of the First Order, he certainly earned his fame. However, he and his men were not the only Koreans who gave a good account of themselves. Thousands of peasants fiercely resisted the Japanese even after they were abandoned by their hapless government. And then there were monks who had lost their status in society, but not their martial traditions. Among these was Sosan, 1520-1604, who remains famous in Korea today for organizing monks to resist the invaders. Also in the list of heroes was the famous Kiseng Nongke, who killed a Japanese commander by holding him in her arms and throwing herself off a cliff, taking him along. It may be just a myth, but one that has entered the mainstream of Korean narrative histories. Hardly had Korea recovered from the Japanese invasions when it was invaded again, this time from the north. In the early 17th century, Nur Hacha, the leader of a Churuchen group known as the Manchus, united the people of Manchuria. In 1616, Nur Hacha founded the state of Qin and began to carry out his ambition to conquer China. The Ming, having rescued the Koreans from the Japanese, now called on them to assist in fighting the Manchus. The Korean ruler Hwang Hae-kun, ruled 1608-23, sent troops to help. But being conscious of how vulnerable his state was to attack from this new barbarian threat, he instructed his military commanders to see which way the battle was turning. When the Manchus began emerging victorious, the Korean forces surrendered without a fight and adopted a policy of neutrality. This might have made practical sense, but it outraged many officials and other members of the elite who felt obligated to help their nominal suzerain in its struggle. What an un-Confucian breach of loyalty this was. Hwang Hae-kun was removed by a coup, and like Yong Sang-kun, was posthumously downgraded to the status of a royal prince, having acted in a manner unworthy of a king. In 1627, the Manchus reacted to the pro-Ming coup by invading Korea, forcing the court to flee to its traditional place of safety on the island of Konghwa. Out of harm's way, the king negotiated a treaty establishing a tributary relationship with the Manchus. However, as they had done with the Mongols before, Once the immediate threat passed, they reneged on the agreement and resumed a pro-Ming policy. Norhaja's successor, Abahai, now calling himself the Emperor of the Qing Dynasty, invaded Korea again in 1636. The court once again retreated to Ganghwa, but this time Abahai's forces managed to capture the island. The king, who had retreated to a fortress south of Seoul with his army, surrendered. The Manchu invasions were less destructive than those by the Japanese, and the interruption of relations with China proved only temporary. In 1644, the Manchus seized Beijing and began ruling China as the Qing Dynasty, and Korea's tributary relations with China resumed. The Hermit Kingdom. Korea in the aftermath of invasions. Koreans never really accepted the idea that the Qing were the legitimate rulers of China, or even that they were fully civilized. To them, China was under barbarian rule. This was unfair to the Qing rulers, who had assimilated much of Chinese culture and acted as good Confucianists. Koreans also looked down on the Chinese elite, who had compromised their Neo-Confucian principles and their dignity by submitting to the alien Manchus. Not all Koreans held the Qing state in disdain. In the 18th century, some Joseon writers praised the commercial development in China. In general, however, Koreans after the mid-17th century saw China as a society that had compromised civilized values by submitting to barbarian rule. Nonetheless, they maintained correct tributary relations with them. Korea also reestablished proper relations with Japan under the Tokugawa shogunate, sending periodic diplomatic and cultural exchange missions to Edo, Tokyo. There was just one problem. The missions could not present their credentials to the Emperor of Japan because, as all good Koreans knew, there was only one emperor, the celestial ruler in Beijing. To smooth this over, the Japanese created a special title, Tycoon, Great Prince, for the Koreans to use when addressing their ruler. This title was picked up by Westerners and is the origin of the word tycoon. Korean visitors came back impressed by the prosperity of Japan, but disgusted at the freedom with which men and women socialized and the incomplete adherence to Confucian norms that they observed. They also found some Japanese customs disgusting, such as the women painting their teeth black. In general, Japan, like Qing China, was found wanting. With China compromised by the rule of a barbarian dynasty and the Japanese tainted by outre customs, Koreans often saw themselves as the truest adherents of the way, and their society as the most civilized. Their kingdom might be small and militarily weak, but they were morally pure and superior to their neighbors. To maintain that purity, and most of all to avoid harm from foreigners, from the 17th century, Joseon attempted to limit contact with the outside world. The nickname Hermit Kingdom, which 19th century Westerners applied to the country, comes from this deliberate seclusion. The lengths that were taken to impose isolation on the nation were extraordinary. Koreans were not allowed to travel abroad except on authorized missions. The size of boats was restricted to prevent fishermen or merchants from sailing to another country. Foreigners were not permitted to enter the country. When several Dutch sailors washed ashore in 1627, they were put to work building guns for the military, but were not allowed to leave. In 1653, 36 Dutch seamen were stranded on the island of Jeju when their ship wrecked there. They, too, were prohibited from leaving. Eight managed to escape, and one, Hendrik Hamel, wrote the first account of Korea in a Western language. There were two exceptions to the prohibitions against outsiders entering the country. Japanese merchants were allowed to trade at Pusan, but were confined to a walled compound called the Weikwan, Japan House, where they had virtually no contact with Koreans except authorized merchants. The other was the embassies that were sent from China. These traveled overland across Korea to Seoul along a prescribed route, and Koreans were forbidden to have contact with them. They entered Seoul through a special gate and stayed within a walled compound. Only authorized Koreans were allowed to interact with them. As a result, the only foreigners in the country saw as little of it as possible and met few local people, not unlike the restrictions that are imposed on visitors to North Korea today. By the 19th century, Korea was perhaps the most isolated major state in the world. The Calm Before the Storm, Late Joseon. If the reign of Sejong marked a high point in the history of pre-modern Korea, the reigns of Kings Yongcho, 1724-76, and his grandson Jongcho, 1776-1800, constituted another final golden age before the turbulent 19th century changed Korean society forever. Yongcho promoted political stability by appointing officials from all the major factions and managed to take some of the heat out of the political intrigues. Perhaps the most skilled leader since Sejong, he also led by moral example, trying hard to fit the Confucian model of kingship. He dutifully performed rituals and held himself to a personal standard of moral rectitude while paying close attention to the governing of the state. After half a century of rule, he was succeeded by his able grandson, Jongcho. Both were skilled at maintaining the loyalty of the powerful aristocratic families while keeping them from openly attacking each other. Yongcho and Jongcho reigned during good times. The country was at peace with its neighbors and prospered at home. Lighter plows and hoes, greater use of fertilizer, more effective intercropping, and some good forest management had improved farm output just enough to support a growing population and keep it well fed. Most of the time. Commerce, while still modest in scale, flourished, with the country adopting a more monetized economy. In literature, it was the great age of the novel. Popular novels from this period are still read today. The best known of these is The Story of Chun Young, a tale of a young lady who falls in the clutches of an evil local official but is rescued by her lover. Some of Korea's greatest painters were active at this time as well, including Kim Hong-do, whose depiction of everyday life, farmers in the field, weavers, people attending village markets, are a delightful record of the times. Other painters devoted themselves to capturing the scenic spots of the country, while still others recorded its beautiful women. The prevailing interest in the past is reflected in the number of histories written at this time, works showing impressively high standards of scholarship. One, composed by Yu Tuk-kong in 1784, began the controversy over whether Korea was really unified by Silla, or there were two Koreas, the other being Palhae, a controversy that continues today. Other scholars compiled maps and geographies of the country. The tranquility was not complete. Factional rivalries were still present, and threats to the Confucian order popped up from time to time. One such incident involved Yongcho's son, the Crown Prince Sato. His behavior became increasingly bizarre, showing signs of serious mental illness, which represented a true crisis for the monarchy. The king ruled by the mandate of heaven. He had to maintain harmony among the people and demonstrate that he and his lineage were worthy of heaven's trust. Failure to maintain harmony and lewd or unseemly behavior could result in the loss of that mandate. And a mentally ill heir to the throne? What could be a clearer sign that the Yi family was losing the pleasure of heaven? Sato's illness had to be kept a secret. On his father's orders, he was suffocated in a rice chest that muffled his cries, while his wife, Lady Hekyong, was ordered to lie beside him as if nothing was wrong. Her extraordinarily insightful account of it all makes for compelling reading. The scheme worked. His death was ruled as natural, and the crown passed to Sato's son, who became King Jongcho. On the Edge of a Storm. The eminent civil servant Kim Jong-hee died in 1856 at the age of 70. From a family of Yongpan in Chungcheong Province in central Korea, he had passed the civil service exam at age 24. Trained for a life of public service, he distinguished himself as a calligrapher. He was interested in old things, the treasures of his country's long traditions. He made a study of old Buddhist texts and had a great passion for collecting inscriptions found throughout the kingdom. Kim also wrote about geology, history, and Confucian doctrine. He witnessed political crises and himself was once exiled to the island of Jeju. Yet his life was overall a good one, filled with pride in his nation's past, its institutions and culture, all of which were still flourishing when he passed away. It is doubtful that Kim Jong-hee could have possibly imagined just how radically Korea's history was about to change. A well-informed Korean in 1856 might have been aware that there was a new threat abroad, that Western barbarians had launched a major attack on China and forced that country to open its ports to trade. But he would not know that this was only the beginning of a great storm soon to sweep across the land, altering the course of Korean history.